are in Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 13 this morning. So please, if you have your Bibles, turn there, follow along. When Clint asked me to speak this week, I saw that it landed on this passage of the ceremonial washing of the hands. And if you know me at all, I'm either the best person in the world to speak on this or the worst. Okay, so I'm not sure which. Okay, so hopefully you're there. Mark chapter 7, verse 1. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were unclean, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as washing of the cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands?" And he replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men.' You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother,' and anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. But you say that if a man says to his father or mother, 'Whatever help you might otherwise have received from me is Corban,' that is, a gift devoted to God, then you no longer let him do anything for his father or mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down." And you do many things like that. All right. Let's take a closer look at what's happening here. We have Jesus and his disciples. They have just come back from the marketplace, and his disciples are eating with unclean hands. Okay, so this is a big no-no, but Mark has to give explanation to this, okay, because his audience here is primarily Gentile. But if you are a Jew, you do not need any explanation here. You know that this is a huge violation of the oral law. Okay, so the Pharisees, they notice this, and they are, if you're not familiar, the Pharisees are an ultra-conservative sect of Jews that highly uphold and regard the oral law. Okay, so we have the oral law, and then we have the written law. Now, the written law is God's commands, his written word, the Mosaic law. Okay, and then we have the oral law. And the oral law is actually human rules and regulations that have been added to God's commands, his written law, all right? And it has good intentions behind it, okay? Because it's added rules and regulations to try and keep the people from breaking God's commands, okay? The last time that Israel broke God's commands, namely not keeping the Sabbath holy and the worshiping of false idols, they were overtaken by their enemies, the temple was destroyed, and they were sent into exile into Babylon for 70 years. Okay, so the Old Testament scribes and the rabbis, they've taken the written law, and they add these human rules and regulations to it to try and help the people to keep from breaking God's commands. Okay, and this one in particular, this ceremonial washing of the hands, this one stems from the written law. This is an oral law, okay? But it stems from the written law found in Exodus 30, where God has commanded the priests to wash their hands and their feet before they enter into the tabernacle. Okay, this is a very public display, an act in front of the people to remind them that they need to go through a ceremonial cleansing. They need to become clean. The priest must be clean before he enters into the tabernacle with a very holy God. Okay, but what's happened is that, so this written law given to the priests, over the centuries, the rabbis and the scribes, they've taken that and they've turned it into, now it's not just for the priests, it's rules and regulations meant for all devout Jews to follow, so that when they come back from the marketplace where they are coming in contact with Gentiles, unclean people, unclean food, that they go through this ceremonial washing to become clean again. Okay? And it really has nothing to do with hygiene. Okay? I'm all about washing of the hands. Okay? Especially when you come back from the marketplace or wherever it is. We do this in our house. But this really has nothing to do with hygiene. If you look at the Greek root, it's more of a sprinkling. It's a pure symbolic and ceremonial act that is kind of put on devout Jews so that they, again, they can be clean after, you know, being around the unclean, okay? So that's what's happening here, all right? So the disciples, Jesus' disciples, have broken this oral law, this oral tradition. It's kind of a big deal. The Pharisees ask Jesus about this, and then Jesus just lays into them. Right? He doesn't even really answer their question. He does, you hypocrites. Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. Your lips and your mouth, you know, honor me, but your hearts are far from me. Okay, so on the surface, it may seem a little extreme. It may seem like, why does he have such an extreme response? So what I'd like to do is look at what's been happening before Mark chapter 7. What's led up to this scene that's caused kind of this huge response from Jesus, okay? So we're going to look at chapters 1 through 6 just real briefly, but I'd like to focus on the interactions, two interactions that Jesus and his disciples are having with two different groups of people, okay? So the interactions of Jesus and his disciples with, number one, crowds of people, just the people, ordinary people, crowds of people, okay? And then highlighting that Jesus and his disciples are primarily preaching and teaching, they're healing sicknesses and disease, and then they are, and he's casting out the demons, okay? The second interaction I'd like to kind of draw attention to would be Jesus and his disciples with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Okay, so again, you don't have to follow along. If you want to, it's fine. We're in Mark chapter 1. We're going to go quickly. After Jesus calls his first disciples, he goes into Capernaum, where he's on the Sabbath in a synagogue teaching. Okay, cast out an evil spirit. As soon as they leave, they go to Andrew and Simon Peter's home. And he heals Peter's mother-in-law of a fever, right? It says in verse 32, that evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and the demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many and had who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons. Okay, so the whole town is gathered at the door. Then he heals a man with leprosy, tells him not to tell anyone. He does anyway. What happens? He can no longer enter towns openly. So then the people still come to him from everywhere. All right, goes back to Capernaum again. We see him at a house. Crowds gather, no room at the door. So the friends of the paralytic bring him in through the roof. He heals him. He also claims, and then here we see an interaction with the teachers of the law where they question his claim to be able to forgive sins. Okay? After he calls the disciple of Levi, right? Again, we see a large crowd gathered. He eats with the tax collectors and the sinners because Levi is a tax collector. And then we see here an interaction with the Pharisees. They are questioning, why is he eating with the tax collectors and sinners? Why are they doing this? Because it's a breaking of one of their oral laws, right? To eat with the sinners. We see the Jesus' disciples, they are not fasting when they're supposed to be fasting. and they are also picking heads of grain on the Sabbath. And both of these, the Pharisees notice. They're watching closely. They're asking questions. Why? Because it's a breaking of the oral laws or traditions. Okay, moving on to chapter 3. We see that Jesus is in a synagogue. It says that the Pharisees are looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Jesus, of course, does in front of everyone to see. And then it says in verse 6, the Pharisees went out and they begin to plot of how they might kill Jesus. Okay? Moving on in chapter 3, the crowds continue to build and gather. All right? So much so that it says that he tells his disciples to have a small boat ready for him, okay, to keep the people from crowding him, for he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. All right? Crowds continue to gather and to gather. Chapter 4, so much so that when he goes to teach his parables, he needs to be in a boat because there's so many people. All right, moving on to chapter 5, we see that he's on his way. Again, there's many in the crowd. Jairus has asked him to come and heal his sick daughter who is dead, and he goes. And then again, the crowds are pushing on him, and what happens? The woman with the bleeding disorder touches him, right? And there's a kind of this big thing because, you know, she touched him in the crowds. She's healed. All the people are pressing around him. Okay, moving on into chapter 6. Again, the crowds continue to gather. So much so, it says that the disciples don't even have a chance to eat. Okay, so he's going to send them off to try to just get some reprieve from all the people. But what happens? They land, and the crowds have followed them, and they're there too. And he doesn't send them away. He has compassion on them. And then him and his disciples feed the 5,000. Okay? So after that, again, Jesus tries to send his disciples off to kind of get away from the crowds. But they're up all night, rowing against the wind. You know, he appears as a ghost. And then we land in verse 54, and it says, as soon as they get out of the boat, people recognize Jesus. They ran throughout that whole region and carried the sick on the mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, villages, towns, countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched him were healed. So this is where we're at when we get to Mark chapter 7. Jesus and his disciples have been with crowds and crowds of people, preaching to them, teaching them, healing them, casting out demons, okay? So much so that they often don't even have time to eat. What's been happening with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law? They've been watching him, looking for reasons to accuse him, right? So when we get to this scene in Mark chapter 7, and the disciples have just come back from the marketplace, and they don't take part in this ceremonial washing of the hands, and the Pharisees come at them again, you've broken the oral traditions, why are you eating with unclean hands? Maybe we can see a little bit more of why Jesus just lays into them, right? You hypocrites. You hypocrites. This passage that he refers to is from Isaiah 29, and I'd like to read a lot of it. So we're going to look there. But he says, you hypocrites, these people come near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship of me is made up only of rules taught by men. Therefore, once more, I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder. The wisdom of the wise will perish. The intelligence of the intelligent will vanish. Woe to those who go to great depths to hide their plans from the Lord, who do their work in darkness and think, who sees us? Who will know? At this point, the Pharisees are planning to kill Jesus, right? And then in verse 6, it says, you turn things upside down as if the potter were thought to be like the clay. I love that. You turn things upside down. That's exactly what's happened in this story. The Pharisees have taken the oral law, human-made traditions and rules, right? And they've flipped it. And they've put it above the Mosaic law, right? The commands of God, the written law. They've turned things upside down. And then Jesus gives this incredible example of this, okay, with this whole concept of Corban. Now, I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Corban, but it basically is an oath or a vow where someone would dedicate all of their wealth, possessions, property to God. But what that would look like is that while they're still living, they can still use all their wealth, possessions, property. And then after they die, it would be given to the temple. Okay? But strangely, while they're living and they're able to use it, they're just not able to use their wealth, possessions, property, anything that they've vowed to God for other people. Okay? So what's happened here, we're not quite sure the exact circumstances, but whether there's some kind of rash oath where someone, dedicates all that they have to God, or maybe they're intentionally using Corban so that they don't have to fulfill, this taking care of their mother and father. But what we do know is that this oral law, they've made an oath, and the Pharisees are saying that this is the most important thing. That no matter what, you cannot use your wealth and possessions and property for the use of others. And so if someone's in a position where they need to take care of their mother and their father, right? And Jesus is really clear when he says, Moses said. Because he's saying, Mosaic law. Moses said, honor your father and mother. This is the written law. This is the fifth commandment. And you're taking this oral law and you're using it in a way where you don't have to uphold the Mosaic law. Okay? Not taking care of your parents would be like cursing them. That is a crime deserving of death. Okay? So you're taking an oath, maybe a rash oath, and you're using that. That's going to be dedicated to the temple, but you're using that so that you don't have to now take care of your mother and your father, of upholding the fifth commandment, the Mosaic law. And the Pharisees have no defense in this. There's no defense. They know that the Mosaic law is the highest, has the highest authority. It is supreme. Nothing can go above the Mosaic law. They know this. There's nothing they can say. Jesus gives the perfect example. He says, and you do many things like this. Okay? And so I want to go back to verse 8 where he, I gotta have the whiteboard. All right. I just like to point. Okay, so verse 8, Jesus kind of goes through this progression where he's talking about the commands of God and the traditions of men. All right? And I wrote the Greek words here just to show just like his wording of how this kind of unfolds. Okay, so in verse 8, he says, you've let go the commands of God, right? This infers like an abandoning, and you're holding on to the traditions of men. It kind of infers like this mastery or control. Okay, and then in verse 9, he said, you've set aside the commands of God, where you're basically denying the validity of the written law. Okay, and then in order to observe or establish your own traditions, this is kind of like a guarding or a keeping, okay? And then when we get to verse 13, that's progressed all the way until it says, thus you nullify the word of God by your own tradition that you've handed down. You do many things like this. So now we've come to nullify, making void, where the Pharisees have essentially removed all power and authority from the written word. All right, so, when we try to add to God's law, right, human laws, traditions, rules, right? When we try and add to that, because there's nothing, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with rules. We have to have rules, okay? We have rules about washing hands. We have rules about technology use. You have rules in your workplace. You have rules at school. But when we're looking at adding human rules and regulations to God's commands to try and produce, you know, certain behaviors, we end up actually subtracting from the moral law, okay? So the irony here is that this kind of like strict obedience to rules, regulations, it actually usually leads to a disobedience to God. That's exactly what we see going on here, right? The Pharisees are so focused on, you know, all of the things that they think need to be right, right? What are they trying to control? They're trying to guard. They're trying to keep. They're so focused on that that they're actually being extremely disobedient to God's commands. I mean, they're plotting to kill Jesus at this point. So, you know, I think when we read passages like this, the tendency can, we can like disassociate ourselves a little bit. It's hard to maybe relate with the Pharisees, especially if you're not like a big rule person. But I keep coming back to, I think in our humanness, we're always going to be more like the Pharisees than the disciples in this story. Okay? So what is it about, what are the things that we need to kind of be looking out for so we can be aware of this? And one of the questions that has been kind of circulating in my mind has been, what happens when the things in our, when things in life that maybe aren't so important, okay, become so important that the things that are actually important cease to be important? All right, it's kind of confusing. I kind of like that it's confusing, but I'm going to say it again. What happens when the things that maybe aren't so important in life? Okay, we all have to ask ourselves what that is for us. All right, what happens when the things that maybe aren't so important, they become so important that the things that are actually important cease to be important? Okay, so I'd like to transition to, I'll give this story. Last year, I would go to the Y to the gym to shoot baskets with Elias, or actually to rebound. He would shoot, I'd rebound. Okay, on the way home, we'd be in the car, and we'd listen to the Jim Rome show. Anyone here fans? I'm like a big fan now, okay? He's a sports talk radio host. He's been doing it for like over 30 years, okay? What's that? I don't know why I like him. I really enjoy listening to him. So anyway, you know, I'm still going to the Y, and I'm listening to him on the way home from a workout, and he's interviewing a college coach who's just kind of come in and trying to turn the culture around, a college football coach, okay? And so he's trying to kind of produce this winning culture. What does that look like? But he said four words that have just really stuck with me. And David and Susan just alluded to it with what they were saying this morning. But he says four words. He's talking again about his, you know, his college football team. But he said, make important things important. All right, make important things. Important. And those four words have just really, really stuck with me. You know, my goal was a little bit this morning to kind of paint this picture between the stark contrast between the Pharisees and then the disciples. That the Pharisees are just, you know, they're on the outside, they're watching, they're accusing, they're criticizing, they're judging. And then you have the disciples who are just, they're just helping people. They're just with the crowds of people, helping hurting people. And I just think about, like, what are some of the things that maybe in life that can kind of move us, you know, we want to be like the disciples in the story, right? But what happens that we can maybe find ourselves over here? Okay, so quickly, I've just identified two, this is just really brief, but two things that I think can be kind of pitfalls for us to be more like the disciples and less like the, or more like the Pharisees and less like the disciples. So the first one would be, and this is obvious, but like an unclean heart. This passage is clearly about what the heart is like. You can go through all kinds of ceremonial cleansings and washings, and that's all external, but that really doesn't get to the problem, right? That doesn't really get to the heart. So if we are dealing with any kind of sin issue, it could be really blatant, it could be really subtle, but that's going to be something that really hinders us, right, from living God's best, all right? And I think, too, when we are dealing with sin issues and we're not really, oftentimes what's happening is we're not dealing with them, okay? So when we don't want to deal with them and we kind of want to avoid and we kind of want to distract ourselves, then that's when we can start to get in some of these unhealthy areas, too. And we can also start to put our stuff out on other people because we don't want to deal with our own stuff. Okay, so that's why I see what's going on with the Pharisees as well. You know, the good news, the gospel, is that there's such a simple remedy for that, right? That we don't have to go through sacrifices and go to the temple and go to priests and do all these external things. It's just such a simple solution. We just have to go to our Heavenly Father, right? Just ask Him for forgiveness, repent, humble ourselves. It's not easy, but it's very simple, right? I love in Psalm 51 when David, he just says, he cries out and he says, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions, wash away my iniquities, cleanse me from my sin." Right? This is a work of the Spirit. That's the good news. Like, this isn't us working to try and get clean hearts, right? We just have to ask. And then the work of the Spirit comes in and cleanses us, and then we're able to be in a position to actually, live in God's best for us. Hebrews says, you know, throw off the sin that hinders and so easily entangles, right? So you can run this race marked out. The second thing that I would say would be, kind of a pitfall or something that would cause us maybe to live more like the Pharisees and less like the disciples would be, I'll say this, our lives feel inconsequential. Our lives feel inconsequential, all right? I hope this makes sense when I read this. Nathan's going to put it up. But this is from just a quick excerpt from Timothy Keller's book here. He's actually quoting a successful editor of a young woman's magazine, okay? And she says this, "Why do we crave celebrities? Here's my theory. To be human is to feel inconsequential. So we worship celebrities and we seek to look like them. All the great things they've done we identify with in order to escape our own inconsequential lives." But it's so dumb. With this stream of perfectly airbrush implanted liposuction stars, you'd have to be an absolute powerhouse of self-esteem not to feel totally inferior before them. So we worship them because we feel inconsequential, but doing it makes us feel even worse. We make them stars, but then their fame makes us feel insignificant. I'm a part of this whole process as an editor. No wonder I feel soiled at the end of the day. Okay? Maybe you don't struggle with this so much, but I think we all struggle with at times in our lives where we feel like we're lacking meaning and purpose, where we feel like maybe we're not living the life that we are really called to live, okay? When we have that void, we don't fill it with God's intention, right? It's going to start showing up in unhealthy ways, okay? Because when that aching is there, we're gonna try and fill that, okay? So if we're not filling it with what God has intended it for us, then it could show up. You know, maybe it's social media. Maybe we have an unhealthy relationship with social media. Maybe it's sports. I don't know, home projects, really building up our careers. It could be ministry. It could be anything, right? Where if we're not really living out our God-given purpose, then we will start to look in other places. And it oftentimes is, it can just be a lot of distraction too. And that's what I think is one of the biggest dangers of our culture today. Just lots of distraction. And we feel this emptiness, and we feel like maybe we're not really doing a whole lot with our lives. And so we just fill it with these other things. Okay, so we've got to be aware as a body of this. So what's maybe the remedy for this? So I think, you know, just like we want to have a clean hearts before God. But I think one of the remedies to feeling like maybe our lives is lacking some meaning and purpose would be to get our hands dirty a little bit. Okay? Maybe just get our hands a little bit more dirty. You see the contrast between the Pharisees and the disciples. The Pharisees, I have to wonder if in all of their search for power, they feel threatened, clearly. They're all about their political agenda, their religious agenda. They're right. I have to wonder if while they're watching this unfold with Jesus and his disciples just helping the crowds of people, if there's something in them that just feels like they're lacking, right? What are they doing with their lives, right? So they just hold tighter. They just guard and keep what they have and hold tighter to it. Instead of maybe letting go a little bit, putting themselves in a position to actually do something worthwhile while they're here on this earth. I'll end with this passage. Matthew chapter 9. Again, Jesus says that he's in the towns and villages. He's teaching, preaching the good news of the kingdom, healing every disease and sickness. And when he sees the crowds, he has compassion on them because they are like sheep without a shepherd. And then I love this. He says to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." I think we're a body of people that does a pretty decent job of loving each other, wanting to see our families thrive, our marriages thrive. But I think we also need to be reminded that we need to be a people that's asking the Lord for the harvest. Okay? And we are asking the Lord to be workers in that harvest field, getting our hands a little bit dirty. I'm speaking to myself here more than anyone. Being willing to be uncomfortable, maybe a little bit more inconvenienced, put our lives, maybe take some risks here and there, but asking the Lord to be workers in his harvest field. Okay, because, again, we can have good intentions, but if we're not asking God and being intentional and, being aware of these things, then we can just kind of drift through life, and then years go by and it's like, what have we been doing? Maybe we've been putting things that aren't so important, and we've just been putting so much of our time and our energy into resources and our resources in the things that really aren't all that important. I want to be a body of people. We're small, but we can have high impact on the city, right? Just because we're small doesn't mean we can't have high impact. So let's be a body of people. And again, this isn't to guilt any of us into anything. This is all a work of the Spirit, right? Anything that's going to actually be fruit is going to be because it's from God and it's his work working in our lives. It's a work of the Spirit. But we've got to be asking. We've got to be asking for clean hearts, right? Pure hearts. We got to be also asking that we can be workers in his harvest field, right? Getting our hands a little bit dirty. And we're more like the disciples. We just want to help hurting people, right? Okay. That's it.